This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents The Calculating Stars, a Lady Astronaut novel. Written and performed by Mary Robinette Kowal.
For my niece, Emily Harrison, who is in the Mars generation. 'Tis thought the king is dead. We will not stay. The bay trees in our country are all withered, and meteors fright the fixed stars of heaven. The pale-faced moon looks bloody on the earth, and lean-looked prophets whisper fearful change. Rich men look sad, and ruffians dance and leap. The one in fear to lose what they enjoy, the other to enjoy by rage and war. These signs forerun the death or fall of kings. Richard II by William Shakespeare. Part 1. 1. President Dewey congratulates NACA on satellite launch. March 3, 1952, AP. The National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics successfully put its third satellite into orbit, this one with the capability of sending radio signals down to Earth and taking measurements of the radiation in space. The president denies that the satellite has any military purpose and says that its mission is one of scientific exploration.
Do you remember where you were when the meteor hit? I've never understood why people phrase it as a question, because of course you remember. I was in the mountains with Nathaniel. He had inherited this cabin from his father, and we used to go up there for stargazing, by which I mean sex. Oh, don't pretend that you're shocked. Nathaniel and I were a healthy young married couple, so most of the stars I saw were painted across the inside of my eyelids. If I had known how long the stars were going to be hidden, I would have spent a lot more time outside with the telescope. We were lying in the bed with the covers in a tangled mess around us. The morning light filtered through silver snowfall and did nothing to warm the room. We'd been awake for hours, but hadn't gotten out of bed yet for obvious reasons. Nathaniel had his leg thrown over me and was snuggled up against my side, tracing a finger along my collarbone in time with the music on our little battery-powered transistor radio. I stretched under his ministrations and patted his shoulder. Well, well, my very own 60-minute man. He snorted, his warm breath tickling my neck.
Does that mean I get another 15 minutes of kissing?
If you start a fire.
I thought I already did.
But he rolled up onto his elbow and got out of bed. We were taking a much-needed break after a long push to prepare for the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics' launch. If I hadn't also been at NACA doing computations, I wouldn't have seen Nathaniel awake any time during the past 2 months. I pulled the covers up over myself and turned on my side to watch him. He was lean, and only his time in the army during World War II kept him from being scrawny. I loved watching the muscles play under his skin as he pulled wood off the pile under the big picture window. The snow framed him beautifully, its silver light just catching in the strands of his blonde hair. And then the world outside lit up. If you were anywhere within 500 miles of Washington, D.C. at 9:53 a.m. on March 3, 1952 and face in a window, then you remember that light. Briefly red and then so violently white that it washed out even the shadows. Nathaniel straightened, the log still in his hands.
Elma, cover your eyes!
I did. That light. It must be an A-bomb. The Russians had been none too happy with us since President Dewey took office. God, the blast center must have been D.C. How long until it hit us? We'd both been at Trinity for the atom bomb tests, but all of the numbers had run out of my head. D.C. was far enough away that the heat wouldn't hit us, but it would kick off the war we had all been dreading. As I sat there with my eyes squeezed shut, the light faded. Nothing happened. The music on the radio continued to play. If the radio was playing, then there wasn't an electromagnetic pulse. I opened my eyes. Right. I hooked a thumb at the radio. Clearly not an A-bomb. Nathaniel had spun away to get clear of the window, but he was still holding the log. He turned it over in his hands and glanced outside.
There hasn't been any sound yet. How long has it been?
The radio continued to play and it was still 60-minute man. What had that light been? I wasn't counting. A little over a minute? I shivered as I did the speed of sound calculations and the seconds ticked by. 0.2 miles per second. So the center is at least 20 miles away? Nathaniel paused in the process of grabbing a sweater and the seconds continued to tick by. 30 miles. 40. 50.
That's a big explosion to have been that bright.
Taking a slow breath, I shook my head, more out of a desire for it not to be true than out of conviction. It wasn't an A-bomb.
I'm open to other theories.
He hauled his sweater on, the wool turning his hair into a haystack of static. The music changed to Some Enchanted Evening. I got out of bed and grabbed a bra and the trousers I'd taken off the day before. Outside, snow swirled past the window. Well, they haven't interrupted the broadcast, so it has to be something fairly benign, or at least localized. It could be one of the munitions plants.
Maybe a meteor?
Ah! That idea had some merit and would explain why the broadcast hadn't been interrupted. It was a localized thing. I let out a breath in relief. And we could have been directly under the flight path. That would explain why there hasn't been an explosion if what we were seeing was just it burning up. All light and fury signifying nothing. Nathaniel's fingers brushed mine and he took the ends of the bra out of my hand. He hooked the strap and then he ran his hands up my shoulder blades to rest on my upper arms. His hands were hot against my skin. I leaned back into his touch, but I couldn't quite stop thinking about that light. It had been so bright. He squeezed me a little before releasing me.
Yes.
Yes, it was a meteor?
Yes, we should go back.
I wanted to believe that it was just a fluke, but I had been able to see the light through my closed eyes. While we got dressed, the radio kept playing one cheerful tune after another. Maybe that was why I pulled on my hiking boots instead of loafers, because some part of my brain kept waiting for things to get worse. Neither of us commented on it, but every time a song ended, I looked at the radio, certain that this time someone would tell us what had happened. The floor of the cabin shuddered. At first I thought a heavy truck was rolling past, but we were in the middle of nowhere. The porcelain robin that sat on the bedside table danced along its surface and fell. You would think that, as a physicist, I would recognize an earthquake faster, but we were in the Poconos, which was geologically stable. Nathaniel didn't worry about that as much and grabbed my hand, pulling me into the doorway. The floor bucked and rolled under us. We clung to each other like in some sort of drunken foxtrot. The walls twisted and then the whole place came down.
I'm pretty sure that I hollered.
When the earth stopped moving, the radio was still playing. It buzzed as if a speaker were damaged, but somehow the battery kept it going. Nathaniel and I were lying pressed together in the remnants of the doorframe. Cold air swirled around us. I brushed the dust from his face. My hands were shaking. Okay?
Terrified.
His blue eyes were wide, but both pupils were the same size, so that was good.
You?
I paused before answering with the social, fine. Took a breath and did an inventory of my body. I was filled with adrenaline, but I hadn't wet myself. Wanted to, though. I'll be sore tomorrow, but I don't think there's any damage. To me, I mean. He nodded and craned his neck around, looking at the little cavity we were buried inside. Sunlight was visible through a gap where one of the plywood ceiling panels had fallen against the remnants of the doorframe. It took some doing, but we were able to push and pry the wreckage to crawl out of that space and clamber across the remains of the cabin. If I had been alone... Well, if I had been alone, I wouldn't have gotten into the doorway in time. I wrapped my arms around myself and shivered despite my sweater. Nathaniel saw me shiver and squinted at the wreckage.
Might be able to get a blanket out.
Let's just go to the car. I turned, praying that nothing had fallen on it, partly because it was the only way to the airfield where our plane was, but also because the car was borrowed. Thank heavens it was sitting undamaged in the small parking area. There's no way we'll find my purse in that mess. I can hotwire it.
4 minutes?
He stumbled in the snow.
Between the flash and the quake.
Something like that. I was running numbers and distances in my head, and I'm certain he was, too. My pulse was beating against all of my joints, and I grabbed for the smooth certainty of mathematics. So the explosion center is still in the 300-mile range?
The air blast will be, what, half an hour later? Give or take?
For all the calm in his words, Nathaniel's hand shook as he opened the passenger door for me.
Which means we have another 15 minutes before it hits.
The air burned cold in my lungs. 15 minutes. All of those years doing computations for rocket tests came into terrifying clarity. I could calculate the blast radius of a V-2 or the potential of rocket propellant. But this was not numbers on a page. And I didn't have enough information to make a solid calculation. All I knew for certain was that, as long as the radio was playing, it wasn't an A-bomb. But whatever had exploded was huge. Let's try to get as far down the mountain as we can before the air blast hits. The light had come from the southeast. Thank God we were on the western side of the mountain, but southeast of us was D.C. and Philly and Baltimore and hundreds of thousands of people, including my family. I slid onto the cold vinyl seat and leaned across it to pull out wires from under the steering column. It was easier to focus on something concrete like hot wiring a car than on whatever was happening. Outside the car, the air hissed and crackled. Nathaniel leaned out the window.
Shit.
What? I pulled my head out from under the dashboard and looked up through the window, past the trees and the snow and into the sky. Flame and smoke left contrails in the air. A meteor would have done some damage exploding over the Earth's surface. A meteorite, though? It had actually hit the Earth and ejected material through the hole it had torn in the atmosphere. Ejecta. We were seeing pieces of the planet raining back down on us as fire. My voice quavered, but I tried for a jaunty tone anyway. Well, at least you were wrong about it being a meteor. I got the car running, and Nathaniel pulled out and headed down the mountain. There was no way we would make it to our plane before the air blast hit, but I had to hope it would be protected enough in the barn. As for us, the more of the mountain we had between us and the air blast, the better. An explosion that bright from 300 miles away? The blast was not going to be gentle when it hit. I turned on the radio, half expecting it to be nothing but silence, but music came on immediately. I scrolled through the dial looking for something, anything that would tell us what was happening. There was just relentless music. As we drove, the car warmed up, but I couldn't stop shaking. Sliding across the seat, I snuggled up against Nathaniel. I think I'm in shock.
Will you be able to fly?
Depends on how much ejecta there is when we get to the airfield. I had flown under fairly strenuous conditions during the war, even though officially I had never flown combat. But that was only a technical specification to make the American public feel more secure about women in the military. Still, if I thought of ejecta as anti-aircraft fire, I at least had a frame of reference for what lay ahead of us. I just need to keep my body temperature from dropping anymore. He wrapped one arm around me, pulled the car over to the wrong side of the road, and tucked it into the lee of a craggy overhang. Between it and the mountain, we'd be shielded from the worst of the air blast.
This is probably the best shelter we can hope for until the blast hits.
Good thinking. It was hard not to tense, waiting for the air blast. I rested my head against the scratchy wool of Nathaniel's jacket. Panicking would do neither of us any good, and we might well be wrong about what was happening. A song cut off abruptly. I don't remember what it was. I just remember the sudden silence and then finally the announcer. Why had it taken them nearly half an hour to report on what was happening? I had never heard Edward R. Murrow sound so shaken.
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt this program to bring you some grave news. Shortly before 10 this morning, what appears to have been a meteor entered the Earth's atmosphere. The meteor has struck the ocean just off the coast of Maryland, causing a massive ball of fire, earthquakes, and other devastation. Coastal residents along the entire eastern seaboard are advised to evacuate inland because additional tidal waves are expected. All other citizens are asked to remain inside to allow emergency responders to work without interruption.
He paused and the static hiss of the radio seemed to reflect the collective nation holding our breath.
We go now to our correspondent Philip Williams from our affiliate WCBO of Philadelphia, who is at the scene.
Why would they have gone to a Philadelphia affiliate instead of someone at the scene in D.C. or Baltimore? At first, I thought the static had gotten worse, and then I realized that it was the sound of a massive fire. It took me a moment longer to understand. It had taken them this long to find a reporter who was still alive, and the closest one had been in Philadelphia.
I am standing on the U.S. 1, some 70 miles north of where the meteor struck. This is as close as we were able to get even by plane due to the tremendous heat. What lay under me as we flew was a scene of horrifying devastation. It is as if a hand had scooped away the Capitol and taken with it all of the men and women who resided there. As of yet, the condition of the president is unknown, but...
My heart clenched when his voice broke. I had listened to Williams report the Second World War without breaking stride. Later, when I saw where he had been standing, I was amazed that he was able to speak at all.
But of Washington itself, nothing remains.
2. Announcer.
This is the BBC World News for March 3rd, 1952. Here is the news, and this is Robert Robinson. In the early hours of the morning, a meteorite struck just outside the capital of the United States of America, with a force greater than the bombs at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The resulting firestorm has swept out from Washington, D.C. for hundreds of miles.
I kept running the numbers in my head after the radio finally reported the news. It was easier than thinking about the big picture, about the fact that we lived in D.C., that we knew people there, that my parents were... From D.C. it would take a little over 24 minutes for the air blast to hit. I tapped the dashboard clock. It should hit soon.
Yeah.
My husband covered his face with his hands and leaned forward against the steering wheel.
Were your parents?
Home. Yes. I could not stop shaking. The only breaths I could draw were too fast and too shallow. I clenched my jaw and held my breath for a moment with my eyes squeezed shut. The seat shifted as Nathaniel wrapped his arms around me and pulled me close. He bowed his head over me so that I was sealed in a little cocoon of tweed and wool. His parents had been older than mine and had passed away some years ago, so he knew what I needed and just held me. I just thought, I mean, Grandma is 103. I thought Daddy was going to go forever. He made a sharp inhalation as if he'd been stabbed. What? Nathaniel sighed and pulled me closer.
There were tidal wave warnings.
Oh, God. Grandma lived in Charleston. She wasn't in a beach house, but still, the entire city was low-lying and right on the coast. And then there were my aunts and uncles and cousins and Margaret, who'd just had a baby. I tried to sit up, but Nathaniel's arms were too tight around me. When will it hit? The meteor struck a little before 10, but how big was it? And the water depth. I need a map and...
Elma.
Nathaniel squeezed me tighter.
Elma, shh. You can't solve for this.
But Grandma...
I know, sweetie, I know. When we get to the plane, we can radio...
The shock of the explosion shattered the car windows. It roared on and on, vibrating through my chest like a rocket leaving a launch pad. The oscillations pressed against my skin, filling every part of my consciousness with roaring waves and then secondary and tertiary explosions. I clung to Nathaniel, and he clung to the steering wheel as the car bucked and slid across the road. The world groaned and roared, and wind howled through the empty window frames. When the sound died away, the car had moved halfway across the road. Around us, trees lay on the ground in tidy rows as if some giant had arranged them. Not all of them were down, but the ones that remained standing had been stripped of snow and whatever leaves they had left. The windshield was just gone. The driver's side window lay on top of us in a laminated sheet of spider-webbed safety glass. I pushed it up, and Nathaniel helped shove it out the door. Blood trickled from little scrapes on his face and hands. I lifted a hand to my face.
You're bleeding.
His voice sounded like he was underwater, and he frowned as he spoke. You too? My own voice was muffled. Ear damage? He nodded and rubbed his face, smearing the blood into a scarlet film.
At least we can't hear the news.
I laughed, because sometimes you have to, even when things aren't funny. I reached over to turn the radio off and stopped with my hand on the dial. There was no sound. This wasn't a matter of being deafened by the blast. The radio was silent. They must have lost their broadcast tower.
See if there's another station.
He put the car into gear and we crept forward a few feet.
No, wait, sorry. We're going to have to walk.
Even if the car had been in pristine condition, there were too many trees down across the road to drive it very far. But it was only 2 miles to the airfield, and we hiked it in the summer sometimes. Maybe. Maybe we could still make it to Charleston before the tidal wave hit, if the plane was okay, if the air was clear, if we had enough time. The odds were against all of those. But what else could I do except hope? We got out of the car and started to walk. Nathaniel helped me scramble over a tree trunk. I slipped in the slush as I stepped down, and if he hadn't had my arm, I would have landed on my rump. I kept trying to hurry, but it wouldn't do anyone any good if I broke my neck or even just an arm. He grimaced at the melting snow.
Temperature is rising.
Maybe I should have packed a swimsuit. I patted his arm as we kept going. I was being flippant in an effort to keep up a brave front, which would help Nathaniel worry less about me. In theory. At least the exertion meant that I had stopped shaking. I hadn't been hearing any birdsong, but I wasn't sure if that was due to the hearing damage or because they weren't singing. The road was blocked in most places, but it was easier to orient ourselves if we stayed along it than if we tried to go cross-country. And we couldn't afford to get lost. It was slow going, and even with the warm air from the blast, we weren't dressed for an extended stay outside.
You don't really think the plane will still be there?
The cuts on Nathaniel's face had stopped bleeding, but the blood and dirt gave him an almost piratical appearance, if pirates wore tweed. I picked my way around the crown of a tree. All other factors being equal, the airfield is closer than town, and there was an arm on the road. No body, just a bare arm. It ended at a rough and bloody shoulder. The specimen had probably been an adult Caucasian male in his 30s. The fingers were curled delicately up to the sky.
God.
Nathaniel stopped next to me. Neither of us were squeamish, and the successive shocks had created a sort of numb haze. I stepped closer to the arm and then looked up the hill. Only a few trees were standing, but their crowns, even denuded of leaves, masked the landscape in a tracery of branches. Hello? Nathaniel cupped his hands around his mouth and hollered, "Hello! Is anyone there?" Except for the wind rustling the branches, the hill was silent. I'd seen worse things than a severed limb at the front when ducking in to pick up a plane and transport it. This wasn't a war, but there would be that many deaths. Burying the arm seemed fruitless. Still, leaving it seemed wrong. I sought Nathaniel's hand. Baruch Dayan Ha'amet. His rough baritone joined mine. Our prayer was less for this unknown man, who probably wasn't Jewish, and more for all the people he embodied. For my parents and all the thousands, the hundreds of thousands of people who had died today. That was when I finally began to weep. It took us another 4 hours to make it to the airstrip. Understand that in the summer we often hiked that route in about an hour. The gentle Pennsylvania mountains were little more than hills. This trip was difficult. The arm was not the worst thing we saw. We encountered no one living on the way down to the airfield. More trees were standing here, although anything with shallow roots was down. But I felt the first hope since the light of the blast because we heard a car. The purr of an automobile idling crept through the trees to meet us. Nathaniel met my gaze, and we started to run down the road, scrambling over trunks and fallen branches, skirting debris and dead animals, skidding in the slush and ash. All the while, the car got louder. When we burst free of the last obstruction, we were across from the airstrip. It was really just a field, but Mr. Goldman had known Nathaniel since he was a kid and kept a strip mowed for us. The barn was twisted at a weird angle, but standing. We'd gotten incredibly lucky. The airstrip was just mowed grass set between the trees on a gentle plateau. It ran roughly east to west and was enough in the direction of the air blast that most of the trees had been pushed down parallel to it, leaving it clear. The road ran along the east end of the airstrip, and then curved to follow it on the north side. There, partially obscured by the remaining trees, was the vehicle that we'd been hearing. It was the red Ford pickup that Mr. Goldman drove. Nathaniel and I hurried down the road and around the bend. The road was blocked by a tree here, and the truck was pressed up against it as if Mr. Goldman were trying to push it out of the way.
Mr. Goldman!
Nathaniel hollered and waved his arms. The windows of the truck were all gone, and Mr. Goldman was slumped against the side of the door. I ran toward the car, hoping he was just unconscious. Nathaniel and I had at least had the benefit of expecting the air blast and had been braced and relatively sheltered when it hit. But Mr. Goldman... I slowed as I reached the truck. Nathaniel used to tell me stories about his childhood trips to the cabin and how Mr. Goldman had always had peppermint stick candy for him. He was dead. I did not need to touch him or feel for a pulse. The tree branch that had been driven through his neck answered that question. 3. Announcer.
This is the BBC World News for March 3rd, 1952. Here is the news, and I'm Raymond Baxter. As fires continue to rage on the east coast of the United States, other countries are beginning to see the first effects of this morning's meteorite strike. Tidal waves are reported in Morocco, Portugal, and Ireland.
As a women Air Force service pilot during the Second World War, I often flew transport missions with planes that were barely airworthy. My little Cessna was more flyable than some of the planes I'd gotten off the ground as a WASP. Dusty and scuffed, yes, but after the most careful pre-flight check in the history of aviation, I got her airborne. As soon as we were up, I made a left bank to turn us south toward Charleston. We both knew it was probably futile, but I had to try. As the plane swung around, what remained of my irrational hope died. The sky to the east was a long, dark wall of dust and smoke lit from beneath by an inferno. If you've seen forest fires, you know a little of what this was like. The current fire stretched to the curvature of the earth as if someone had peeled back the mantle and opened a gateway into hell itself. Streaks of fire lit the sky as ejecta continued to fall to the earth. Flying into that would be madness. Everything to the east of the mountains had been flattened. The air blast had laid the trees out in weirdly neat rows. In the seat beside me, just audible over the roar of the engine, Nathaniel moaned. I swallowed and swung the plane back around to the west. We have about 2 hours of fuel. Suggestions? Like me, he tended to do better if he had something to focus on. When his mother died, he built a deck in our backyard, and my husband is not terribly handy with a hammer. Nathaniel scrubbed his face and straightened.
Let's see who's out there.
He reached for the radio, which was still tuned to the Langley Tower.
Langley Tower, Cessna 416 Baker, request VFR traffic advisories, over.
Static answered him.
Any radio, Cessna 416 Baker, request VFR traffic advisories, over.
He dialed through the entire radio frequency, listening for someone broadcasting. He repeated his call on each while I flew. Try the UHF. As a civilian pilot, I should have just had a VHF radio. But because Nathaniel worked with the NACA, we had a UHF installed as well so he could listen directly to pilots who were on test flights. We never cluttered the military channels by broadcasting, but today... today I just wanted anyone to answer. As we made our way west, the devastation lessened, but only in comparison to what lay behind us. Trees and buildings had been knocked down by the blast. Some were on fire, with no one to put them out. What had it been like to not understand what was coming?
Unidentified Cessna, Sabre 2-1. All non-essential air traffic is grounded.
At the sound of a living human, I started to weep again. But this was not a time to indulge in compromised vision. I blinked my eyes to clear them and focused on the horizon.
Roger, Sabre 2-1, Cessna 416 Baker. Request advice on clear landing areas. Heading 270.
16 Baker, copy that. I'm right above you. Where the hell are you coming from?
His voice had the telltale hiss and rattle of an oxygen mask. and behind that was the thin whine of a jet engine. Looking back and up, I could just make out the F-86 and his wingmen farther back, gaining on us. They would have to circle because their stall speed was faster than my little Cessna could fly.
Hell seems pretty accurate.
Nathaniel rubbed his forehead with his free hand.
We were in the Poconos when the meteorite hit.
Jesus, 1-6 Baker. I just flew over that. How are you alive?
I've got no idea. So, where should we set down?
Give me a sec. I'll check to see if I can escort you to Wright-Patterson.
Roger. Would it help to mention that I'm a retired army captain and still work with the government?
With the government? Please tell me you're a senator.
Nathaniel laughed.
No, a rocket scientist with the NACA. Nathaniel York.
The satellites! That's why you sounded familiar. I heard you on the radio. Major Eugene Lindholm, at your service.
The man on the other end of the line was silent for a couple of minutes. When it crackled back to life again, he said,
Got enough fuel to reach Wright-Patterson?
I'd flown into that airbase multiple times, moving planes during the war. It was approximately 150 miles from where we were. I nodded as I adjusted course to head us there. Nathaniel nodded in acknowledgement and lifted the mic again.
We do.
Great. You'll be there in time for dinner. Not that it's much to look forward to.
My stomach growled at the mention of food. We hadn't eaten since dinner the night before, and I was suddenly ravenously hungry. Even water would be welcome. When Nathaniel signed off, he leaned back in his seat with a sigh. Looks like you have a fan. He snorted.
We should have seen it.
What?
The meteorite. We should have seen it coming.
It wasn't your job.
But we were looking for things that would interfere with the satellites. You'd think we'd spot a goddamn asteroid that was this close.
Low albedo? Trajectory that put it in line with the sun? Small?
We should have seen it!
And if you had, what could we have done? The sound of the engine vibrated the seat beneath me and underscored the hiss of air slicing past. One of Nathaniel's knees bounced up and down with nervous energy. He sat forward and grabbed the charts.
Looks like you'll need to lay a course southwest.
I'd already done that, and we had an escort, but if giving me directions made Nathaniel feel useful, then by God, he could guide me all the way there. Every streaking flare of ejecta in the sky just drove home how helpless we were. I could see them, but not in time to do anything about them. So I kept my hands on the yoke and flew. The good thing about the constant pinch of hunger was that it countered the soothing drone of the airplane and kept me awake. Well, that and Nathaniel's terrible baritone. My husband was many things, but a singer was not one of them. Oh, he could carry a tune in a bucket filled with gravel. Fortunately, he knew that and leaned toward a comedic repertoire in his efforts to keep me awake. Bellowing with a vibrato like an amorous goat, Nathaniel stomped his foot on the floorboards of the airplane.
Oh, do you remember Grandma's lye soap? Good for everything, everything in the place. The pots and kettles, and for your hands, and for your face.
Below us, the glorious side of the Wright-Patterson airfield finally scrolled into view. Its identification light flashed green, then the double white of a military field.
Mrs. O'Malley, down in the valley, suffered from ulcers, I understand.
Saved! I adjusted altitude. Let him know we're coming in? Nathaniel grinned and grabbed the mic.
Sabre 2-1, 1-6 Baker. So how's the food on the base?
The radio crackled and Major Lindholm laughed.
It's everything you would expect, and more.
Not bad, eh?
I did not say that, sir. But if you're real nice, I might share my wife's care package.
I laughed along with Nathaniel far more than the joke deserved. Nathaniel switched the radio to the tower frequency, but before he could get the mic to his lips, another voice crackled out.
Aircraft on heading 260, 8,500 feet. This is Wright-Patterson Tower. Identify yourself.
Wright-Patterson Tower, this is Cessna 416 Baker at 8,500 direct to the field.
Nathaniel had flown with me often enough that he had the routine down. He lowered the mic for a moment, then grinned and raised it again.
And, Tower, we have Sabre 2-1 flight in tow.
Tower, Sabre 2-1, we are escorting 1-6 Baker. Request direct to the field.
I snorted. It had to irk a fighter pilot to be trailing a scrubby little plane like my Cessna.
1-6 Baker and Sabre 2-1 tower copies. Approved direct to the field. Remain clear of 1-6 Baker. Be advised, we have reports of...
Light streaked past the nose of the plane. A crack like a bomb going off. The entire plane bucked. I wrestled it level again. And suddenly I could see the propeller. The nearly invisible blur had become a stuttering, uneven bar. Part of it was just gone. It took me a moment to grasp what had happened. That streak of light had been a chunk of ejecta slamming into the nose of the plane, and it had taken part of my propeller with it. The engine vibration shook the yoke in my hand and slammed the seat against the base of my spine. This was only going to get worse. It could shake the engine right out of the plane. I slammed it into idle and began the sequence to secure the engine, by which I mean shut it down. Damn it. I wasn't going to make the base. I need a landing field now. At least we were in farm country, although the snow was going to mask the actual terrain. I pulled the throttle knob all the way out to idle, and the engine shut off, leaving only the hiss of wind around us. What was left of the propeller windmilled as air rushed over it.
What?
Gliding. If the ejecta had hit a wing, we'd be in much worse trouble, but the Cessna was a darn good glider. I just wouldn't get a second chance at landing. There was a road cutting between the fields, which might be a good bet if it weren't for the fences bordering it. Field it was. I banked to line up the approach. In the corner of my eye, Nathaniel still clutched the microphone. As a wasp, I'd had engines cut out on me far too often. This was his first time. He brought the radio to his mouth, and I was so proud of how steady his voice was.
Right, Tower, this is Cessna 416 Baker declaring an emergency. We've had an engine failure and are making a forced landing on a field,
He fumbled for the map.
Cessna 416 Baker, right, Tower. We have eyes on you. You just concentrate on landing. Sabre 2-1, right, Tower. Orbit to assist and pinpoint where they land.
Right, Tower, Sabre 2-1, already on it.
The roar of the jet passed overhead as Major Lindholm and his wingman did a wide sweep past us. My pulse thrummed through my veins, taking the place of the engine noise. This was not my first unpowered landing, but it was the first time with my husband aboard. After everything else that had happened today, I would not be the cause of his death. I refused. Buckled up?
Yeah.
But he was fastening his seatbelt as he spoke, so it was a good thing that I had asked.
Can I do... anything?
Brace. I tucked in my chin and watched the altimeter.
Anything else?
Don't talk. He just wanted to help, but I didn't have time for that. I had to slow the plane as much as possible before I touched down, but not so much that we landed short of the field. The ground rose up to meet us, changing from a smooth, white expanse to a model train set of a snowy field, and then, without transition, full size and beneath us. I kept the nose up so that the tail wheel touched down first. The snow grabbed at the wheel, slowing us further. As long as I could, I kept the nose tipped up. When the wing wheels finally touched, one of them snagged on the uneven rows beneath the snow. The plane jolted. I clutched the yoke to keep the wings level and worked the rudder pedals, trying to turn in the direction of the wind. Our turn continued until we were facing the direction that we'd come. The plane stopped. Around us, the world was silent and still. All the air in my lungs hissed out at once. I sagged against the seat. A jet engine roared overhead and the radio crackled. Major Lindholm's voice filled the cabin.
1-6 Baker, nicely done. Are you two okay?
Nathaniel sat up and reached for the mic. His hand was shaking.
We aren't dead, so yes.
The congealed mass of kidney beans and utterly questionable meatloaf may have been the best things I had ever tasted. The beans had a sweet tang to them and puckered the inside of my mouth with too much salt, but I closed my eyes and relaxed against the hard bench in the Air Force canteen. It was weirdly empty, since much of the base had been deployed to deal with relief efforts. Some crockery rattled against the table and brought with it the glorious scent of chocolate.
When I opened my eyes, Major Lindholm settled onto the bench across from us. The picture I'd built of him in my head had no bearing on reality. I'd expected an older man, Nordic blonde and stocky. The real Major Lindholm was black, and younger than I'd expected from his voice. He was a hale man in his late 30s with dark hair still mashed down from his helmet. The red line of his face mask traced a triangle around his chin and nose. And he brought hot chocolate. Nathaniel lowered his fork and eyed the three steaming mugs on the table. He swallowed.
Is that hot cocoa?
Yeah, but don't thank me. It's a bribe so I can ask you questions about rockets.
Lindholm pushed two of the mugs across the table.
From the stash my wife sends to work with me, not the Air Force stuff.
If you weren't already married... My hand had closed around the warm mug before I realized what I'd said. I hoped he wasn't offended. He laughed, thank God.
I've got a brother.
My heart clenched hard. I'd managed to put my family out of my mind in order to keep going, but my brother lived in California. Herschel must think I was dead. My breath shuddered as I inhaled, but I managed to find a smile somewhere and looked up. Is there a phone I can use? Long distance? Nathaniel rested his palm against my back.
Her family was in D.C. Oh, jeez, ma'am. I'm so sorry.
But my brother, he's in California.
You come with me, ma'am.
He glanced at Nathaniel.
Is there anyone you need to call, sir?
Nathaniel shook his head.
Not urgently.
I followed Major Lindholm with Nathaniel at my back, through corridors that barely registered. What an inconsiderate brat I'd been. I'd taken comfort that Herschel and his family lived in California, but hadn't once thought about the fact that to him I was as good as dead. He had no reason to think that I wasn't in D.C. when the meteorite struck. The office Major Lindholm showed me to was small and military tidy. The only thing that marred the right angles was a framed photo of twin boys and a crayon-drawn map of the U.S. pinned to the wall. Nathaniel shut the door and stood outside with Lindholm. A utilitarian black phone sat on the desk, but at least it had a rotary dial so I wouldn't have to speak with an operator. The receiver was warm and heavy. I dialed Herschel's home, listening to the rattle of the rotary as it swept through the numbers. Each signal sent a pulse through the lines and gave me time to retreat into a mechanical calm. All I got was the high, frantic hum of a busy circuit. It was hardly surprising that all the circuits would be busy, but I hung up and tried again immediately. My urgency beat in time with the busy signal. I had barely hung up again when Nathaniel opened the door.
Company, you okay?
Circuit's busy. I wiped at my face, probably just smearing the dirt more. I would ask to send a telegram, but the military signalers would be tied up. I'll try later. There was a lot to be said for being alive and upright. I was a greasy, smoky, bleeding mess, but I was alive. My husband was alive. My brother and his family were alive. And if I needed a reminder that this was a blessing, all I had to do was remember how many people had died today. Still, when an Air Force colonel strode into the room, I caught myself trying to brush my hair into place as I stood, as if it would make a difference. Then I saw past the insignia to the man. Stetson Parker. Thank heavens I had enough dirt on my face that I didn't have to worry about guarding my expression. The jerk had been promoted. This was not remotely surprising, since he was a charmer to anyone who outranked him, or who he needed. As he proceeded to demonstrate now with an outstretched hand toward Nathaniel.
Dr. York, I can't tell you what a relief it is to know you're safe.
Even with Lindholm's earlier enthusiasm about rockets, it was easy to forget that Nathaniel had become a celebrity because of the satellite launch. We'd managed to beat the Russians to getting a satellite into orbit not once, but with three different launches. My husband, being unreasonably attractive and charming, a fact about which I am not biased, had become the face of the NACA space program.
Well, Major Lindholm has been taking good care of us. We appreciate the welcome, Colonel...
The man had a name tag on, but still, an introduction was appropriate.
Where are my manners? I'm just so awestruck to have you here.
Parker gave a shit-eating grin.
Colonel Stetson Parker, base commander. Although, with affairs being what they are, I appear to be in charge of more than just this base.
Of course he would get that in to make it clear how important he was. I stepped forward and stuck out my hand. Good to see you again, Colonel Parker. He raised his eyebrows in surprise.
I'm sorry, ma'am. You have the better of me.
Oh, when you knew me, I was still Elma Wexler, one of the WASP pilots. His face stiffened a little.
Ah, the general's daughter. Yes, I remember you.
Congratulations on your promotion. I smiled the best bless-your-heart smile I could. You must have worked very hard for it.
Thank you, ma'am.
He grinned again, clapping Nathaniel on the shoulder.
And I guess the little lady got a promotion, eh? Becoming Mrs. York?
My teeth hurt from grinding, but I kept smiling. You mentioned not knowing who your superior is. What can you tell us about the current situation?
Ah.
He sobered, and the mood change might even have been real. He gestured to the seats on the other side of the desk.
Sit down, please.
Parker took the chair behind the desk, and only now did I notice his nameplate set front and center. I was surprised he had twins. I wonder who'd married him. He steepled his fingers together and sighed again.
An explosion?
A meteorite.
That's what the news reported, but given that Washington was wiped out, I place my money on the Russians.
Nathaniel cocked his head.
Is there radioactivity? We haven't gotten anyone close enough to the blast area to check.
Idiot. I spelled things out for him. There's ejecta falling all around, which, first of all, you could just test for radioactivity. Second, that's not something that happens with an A-bomb. It occurs when a meteorite punches a hole in the atmosphere, and the blast material is sucked into space, then falls back to Earth. His eyes narrowed.
Then know this. The United States Congress was in session, both the House and the Senate. Our federal government was nearly entirely wiped out. The Pentagon, Langley. So even if this was an act of God, do you honestly think the Russians won't try to take advantage of it?
That was a terrifyingly good point. I leaned back in my chair and crossed my arms over my chest to ward off the sudden chill in the air. Nathaniel filled in the gap.
So the military is planning a defense?
He didn't quite emphasize military, but did make it clear enough that whatever happened, a colonel was not going to be running the show.
It's the prudent thing to do. Dr. York.
He paused, but the hesitation was so blatantly calculated that you could almost see him counting the seconds.
You worked on the Manhattan Project. Am I correct?
Nathaniel stiffened next to me. The Manhattan Project had been exciting from a scientific standpoint, but horrific in every other respect.
I did. But I'm focused on space exploration these days.
Parker waved that away.
I hate to do this to you after your arduous morning, but may I pull you into a meeting? I'm not sure that I really have anything to offer. You're with the top scientist in rocketry right now.
Neither of us needed a reminder of how many people at the NACA were likely dead. I rested my hand on Nathaniel's knee to steady him as he had steadied me. The NACA, however, was not the only rocketry program. Not to undervalue my husband's work, but Wernher von Braun is at the Sunflower Project in Kansas. Parker snorted and gave me a pained smile. He'd hated being polite to me during the war, when he had to because of my father. And now he hated being polite to Dr. York's wife.
Ma'am, it's nice that you want to help, but I hope you understand that I can't involve a former Nazi like von Braun in questions of national security.
And then he was looking at Nathaniel again, ignoring me completely.
What do you say, Dr. York? We just want to understand what our options are for keeping America safe.
Nathaniel sighed and picked at a loose thread on his trousers.
All right, but I'm not promising to be bright today.
As he stood, I straightened my legs to join him. Parker held his hand up and shook his head.
No need, ma'am. You can just rest here in my office while Major Lindholm arranges quarters for you.
The major said,
We have some empty rooms at our place, if you want to avoid the TLFs.
I was flattered. Not that he'd offered a place to stay, but that he used the acronym for temporary living facilities instead of translating for a civilian. That's very kind, if your wife doesn't mind, Major.
I'm sure she won't, ma'am.
Parker's smile was unexpectedly warm.
You're in good hands. His wife makes darn fine pie.
I'll admit that I was surprised to see what appeared to be genuine camaraderie between the two men. My own experiences with Parker had been less than ideal. I hoped that didn't mean that Major Lindholm would turn out to be charming but unpleasant, too. Thank you. Now that that's sorted, we can go on to the meeting. Not that I had any desire to go to a meeting, but I would give a lot to feel like I could be of some use.
Ah, I'm sorry, ma'am.
Parker tugged at his tie.
What I should have said was that Dr. York already has the necessary clearance levels from the Manhattan Project. You understand.
Clearance my ass. From what he was saying, there was no hierarchy at all, much less clearance. But if I voiced any of that, nothing useful would follow, so I settled back in my chair. Well, bless your heart, of course I understand. I'll just sit here and wait. Nathaniel raised his brows at that. He knew me well enough to know I was good and angry, if not exactly why. I shook my head at him, reassuring him that I was fine. I smiled, folded my hands demurely in my lap, and settled back. Like a good little girl, I would sit and wait, let my husband do the work, and pray to God that this Michigas wasn't going to start a nuclear war. 4.
90 die, an Iran earthquake. Tehran, Iran, March 3rd, 1952. Reuters. 90 persons were killed and 180 injured in earthquakes in Lorestan and Bastak in southern Iran. Tehran Radio announced today that the earthquakes are believed to have been triggered by the meteor impact in North America.
The sun had set in a vivid vermilion with copper and streaks of dark gold. We might well have been transported to Mars based on the red sky arching over us. The ruddy light stained everything so that even the white picket fence of Major Lindholm's house looked as if it had been dipped in blood. Normally I'd hate to impose on anyone, but Parker had irked me. And truly I was too tired to think and grateful to have someone tell me where to go. Besides, they'd be needing the TLFs for refugee housing. Nathaniel was still tied up with his meeting. He'd come out long enough to encourage me to go, and I really didn't have any excuse for staying on base, aside from the absolute certainty that if I left, I would never see him again. These are not things that one voices aloud. Not on a day like today. As I got out of the jeep, the stains on my clothes seemed to deepen. I could almost hear my mother saying, "Elma, what will people think?" I clutched the door of the jeep and bit down on the grief. At least I'd washed my face. Straightening, I followed Major Lindholm through the fence and up the tidy walk to the front porch. The door opened as we were climbing the steps, and a plump woman in a powder blue dress stepped out. Her skin was no darker than Nathaniel gets in the summer, and her features were soft and rounded. I realized, with a little bit of a shock, that I'd never been to the home of a black person before. Mrs. Lindholm's curls had been teased into a bouffant hairdo that framed the curve of her light brown cheeks. Behind her glasses, her eyes were rimmed red and tight with worry. She pulled the door open wider and pressed a hand to her bosom. "Oh, my poor dear, you come right in." "Thank you, ma'am." The floor inside was a pristine faux brick linoleum. My shoes were so dirty that the original color was gone. "Just let me take my boots off."
"Don't you worry about that."
I sat on the steps to pull them off. Mama would have been ashamed of me if I had carried this much grime into anyone's home. "My husband will track in enough dirt for both of us when he arrives." She laughed.
"Aren't husbands just all alike?"
"I'm right here."
Major Lindholm paused on the steps next to me.
"But you let us know if you need anything. Anything at all. And I'll make sure Dr. York gets back here safe and sound."
"Thank you." If I had to see another look of kindness, I would come completely apart. I concentrated on the other boot. Even my stockings were filthy, and my feet weren't much better. Mrs. Lindholm took a few steps out onto the porch.
"I raised 3 sons. Believe me, a little dirt is not a problem."
No tears. Not yet. A shallow breath kept the worst of it from flooding out. I swallowed the salt. Grabbing the railing, I pulled myself up to my bare feet. "I really can't thank you enough."
"Oh, I haven't done anything yet."
She put her hand near my back, not quite touching me, and guided me into her home.
"Now, I suspect that the first thing you'll want is a nice hot bath."
I would take a cold shower at this point. The front door had opened directly into her living room. All the furniture sat at neat right angles, and even the tchotchkes had been squared with the edges of their shelves and tables. The air smelled of lemon furniture cleaner and cinnamon.
For a cold shower, you could have stayed in the barracks.
Mrs. Lindholm bustled down the hall off the living room and opened the first door on the right. Most of the floor in the bathroom was given over to a clawfoot tub.
I have bubble bath, lavender, and rose.
I should probably shower first. She adjusted her glasses, taking in the dirt that caked my clothing and visible skin.
All right. But after that, you soak, you hear me? Else you'll be all over aches and pains tomorrow.
Yes, ma'am. She wasn't wrong. Given everything, I'd be surprised if I could even get out of bed tomorrow.
Now, here are your towels and a set of my oldest son's PJs.
She put her hand on a set of red flannel pajamas.
My nightgowns would just fall off of you. Just set your clothes on the counter and I'll get them washed.
As she bustled out of the room, I nodded, hoping she would take it as thanks. She had to wash my clothes, because otherwise I would have nothing to wear. Not in the despairing debutante way, but a literal fact. We were refugees. Our home, our jobs, our bank, our friends. Everything had been destroyed when the meteorite hit. And if Nathaniel had not been a rocket scientist, if Parker hadn't needed him, where would we be? I had thought about people like Mr. Goldman, but not about the people who lived. What were all the other hundreds and thousands of people who were on the edges of the destruction to do? A cloud of steam preceded me out of the bathroom. I crept down the hall in my borrowed flannel pajamas. The trousers were fine, since I have long legs, but the sleeves hung down to my fingers. I rolled them up as I walked, and the myriad nicks on my fingers snagged against the soft fabric. My mind seemed empty of thought. I think I was still in shock, which was to be expected, I suppose, but at least it wasn't manifesting with tremors anymore. It just seemed as if everything had been swathed in cotton. In the living room, the television was on, but turned down low. Mrs. Lindholm had pulled her chair close to the screen. She hunched forward, staring at the news with her hands balled and fists around a handkerchief. Rendered in flickering black and white, Edward R. Murrow sat at his news desk with a cigarette and spoke about the events of the day.
The latest total of known dead in the wake of the meteor that struck today was 70,000, although that estimate is expected to rise. 500,000 persons have been reported homeless in the states of Maryland, Delaware, Pennsylvania, New York, New Jersey, Virginia, and into Canada, and as far down the eastern seaboard as Florida. These images were taken by airplane some 5 hours after the disaster. What you are looking at, ladies and gentlemen, was formerly the site of our nation's capital.
The screen showed a pool of water bubbling like a geyser. I inhaled sharply as the camera panned to show the horizon, and the scale became clear. The border of dark soil was a ring of scorched earth hundreds of miles in diameter. At the coast, the Chesapeake Bay had not simply flooded its banks. The banks had ceased to exist. I was looking at the sea, and it was steaming. I sucked in breath as if someone had punched me in the gut. Mrs. Lindholm turned in her chair, and I could almost see her folding her own shock and grief away into neat squares so she could be a good hostess.
Oh, you look like you're feeling a little better.
Yes. I took a step closer to the television, horrified and fascinated in equal measure.
A state of emergency has been declared across the eastern seaboard. The Army, Navy, Air Force, and Red Cross have mobilized and are providing aid to refugees in need.
The camera cut to footage from the ground of aid workers gathering refugees. In the background, a little girl with burns on her arms toddled next to her mother. Another cut to what had been an elementary school. The children's bodies.
It must have been morning recess when the meteorite struck. I had thought that anything I could imagine would be worse than the reality. I was wrong.
Mrs. Lindholm turned off the television.
There now, you don't need to be watching that. What you need is some dinner.
Oh, I don't want to be a bother.
Nonsense. I wouldn't have told Eugene to bring you if you were going to be a bother.
She tucked her handkerchief into the waistband of her skirt as she stood.
Come into the kitchen and let me get a little food into you.
I thank you.